I don't know if they sampled Hey Arnold or, like, did you ever watch Hey Arnold?
I was a little bit too old for Hey Arnold.
That's see, you were probably in your 30s right now, right?
Yeah.
You're not even too old for Hey Arnold right now. It's a great show. Just a great show. And you're from New York. Hey Arnold is based in New York. Did you go to PS 131 or something?
I grew up in Connecticut.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You just emigrated to New York, and now you're about to bounce out, aren't you?
Yeah. About to move up to Westchester.
Is that moving up, or isn't that moving down?
Well, geographically, it's moving up.
But it's moving down, isn't it? Because, like, you live in the most gentrified place in the world called Brooklyn. You got Barclay Center fights, and then you're going to go to Westchester?
I mean, I don't need to get into the details of this, but the place we're moving isn't too shabby. I don't think I need to share more details about my personal life, but yeah, it's just fine.
One last question. I have two questions. One, is it close to Bristol, Connecticut?
It is not. Is this an ESPN segue?
Yeah, it's because Bristol is where ESPN is based.
Yeah, we're moving to a small town. It's actually a village
that's on
the Hudson River. So we're specifically, as it relates to any commuters who live in the New York area, we're going to be on the Hudson line as opposed to the New Haven line, which would get you out to Connecticut. So it's
That Vince McMahon lives in Westchester?
Pretty sure he lives in Greenwich. I used to run by his house.
And do what?
No, well, so he lived. This is a whole
running by his house. What'd you do?
In an area called Conyers Farms in Greenwich. Yeah, I lifeguarded at a country club one summer, so I would go running from the country club, and I would run past the area where he lived.
I had to
so
run
not
past
literally
the country
his
club
because he has a
before.
Giant estate. But yeah, so not literally his house, but yeah, the area where he lived.
Because I was stealing stuff.
Really? Did you actually steal from a country club, or are you just trying to?
No, come on. I wouldn't have been allowed in the first place. How was I going to get in? This ain't Caddyshack. Come on.
Just put on a polo shirt, some whale pants. You'll be all set.
Okay. Now, we should get into, first of all, thanks for being a listener. If you aren't subscribed to this podcast, you should definitely do that. If you haven't rated it, you should do that. I mean, you got to give it 5 stars just for Tom and him moving up or down in life, whatever, however you see it. Shout out to Tom. And also, we have a Patreon page. You get daily podcasts. If that's something that you're interested in, head on over to Patreon, become a backer over there. It's easier than you think. Just like fighting Jonathan Barros. What an easy fight for Miguel Burchell. I mean, quick stoppage, referee. Well, actually, you know, the trainer is not supposed to do what he did. Like, the trainer is never supposed to enter the ring. Like, that's like a DQ. Like, that's like, you know, no good. But the referee did what he did. Barros put up more of a fight against his trainer than he did against Burchelt. And so, nothing to learn from this fight. Like, Burchelt is clearly healthy. So, I'll ask you the more loaded question of, are you convinced that Miguel Burchelt is the number one guy at 130 pounds?
No. I would definitely rate Gervonta Davis above him and pick him to beat him. I have to say, though, just to go back for a second, I had talked up Barros a little bit. I mean, I at least tried to say, you know, he's a valid opponent. He had gone the distance with Lee Selby recently, which, you know, I guess is somewhat devalued. But he got knocked out by Mikey Garcia, but he had, you know, gone 8 rounds with him. I thought he was going to be a little more durable, but, you know, at a certain point, Barros is 34. You know, he's just washed up. I mean, at a certain point, fighter will get older, and then just go off a cliff. And it looked like Burchelt got him at the right time. So, yeah.
I mean,
he did not end up putting up much resistance.
Yeah, I was gonna say, let me finish that for you. You're struggling there. So it's pretty clear. I think that Burchelt is one of the top guys at 130 pounds. But to say, so here's the thing, this is like a dilemma for me. Okay. So you have 130 pound division, you have some guys that are pretty talented. and you have some guys that clearly look like they might be the best of the division. But I don't feel confident telling you or anyone, as far as my opinion goes, who the best is. Now, naturally, as far as achievement goes, Burchell and Davis both have arguments. But that would be the merit-based argument. And the argument that, or at least the discussion to have, is who do you think is the best guy? Like, as far as talent goes. Now, obviously, when Lomachenko was at the division, it was Lomachenko, and I think he's clearly better than Burchell and Davis. But with him out of the picture, we have a division that's much like 140 pounds. And this leads into another question of, do you like it better, or is it even better for boxing when you have a division like 130, where you have a couple of guys that are in the conversation? You wouldn't be shocked if some of the other guys emerged, not to say that they beat them, but they emerge as worthy of being in their tier. Or do you think it's better when you have one guy who's clearly the man in the division and everyone else is inferior?
Well, I think I view it through the lens of, like, are we going to get good fights? What is the situation that's going to result in the most good fights happening? And I think, unfortunately, 130 is a problem where it's completely fractured, which can be good, you know, if the fighters have a way to fight each other, like a mechanism like the World Boxing Super Series. You know, that was fantastic at cruiserweight, where you got almost all the top guys together. It looks like bantamweight has gotten together a really good group of guys. 140, I think, they've announced they're going to do 140. It remains to be seen who they'll actually get for that. But the problem at 130 is you have all of the interesting fights are kind of spread out, and the guys really don't have any incentive to fight each other. Davis is probably the biggest draw to the group, but he's still kind of in the sort of, I don't know, I'm going to invent a new term, like power undercard slot, where like he'll be on the Barclays Center undercards and sell a lot of tickets, but he's not headlining. Burchell, not really convinced he's a draw anywhere, but you know, it's not a situation where there's like a money fight, where like a Davis fight can bring up so much money that they can get Burchell to cross lines to fight him. I mean, I think unfortunately we're going to see more of this type of situation where they're just kind of bringing in opponents. I mean, it looks like Davis has a little bit of a thing going with
Tevin
Farmer. Yeah. He's not in the BoxRec rankings for some reason, I guess because he, you know, officially lost that fight. So BoxRec just drops him straight out. I don't know. How would you answer that question? As far as, you know, better to have a, you know, top heavy versus more spread out.
I like the top heavy. I think it leads to more intrigue in the division. When you have a division that no one knows what's what, that division doesn't get talked about. 140 has not been discussed the way it was when Crawford was there, because while it's a boring and dominating conversation of who could beat Terrence Crawford at 140 or who could beat, for the longest time, who could beat Golovkin at 160 or who could beat Mayweather, which was the one that we dealt with for, what, a decade? It brought so much intrigue because we actually started to do the homework of who can be the guy to beat the top guy.
Yeah.
And when you have it spaced out and nobody quite has a name, because usually when you're that top guy in the division, you have a bit of a name. And with 130, you have these guys who are just kind of like, as you said, they're like semi-main eventers. Like, you could toss them in, but it's got to be a small venue. And you're not going to, you can't really expect too much. When you have a top guy, things are much different. You have a guy who's clearly established himself both in the eyes of fans, as well as everyone,
pundits, I guess.
And that's why I'm so. You brought up the World Boxing Super Series and the 140 division. It's okay for that. I think it's okay for that because in the end, we have the promise that by the end of the tournament, we'll know who's for real. And you have enough decent guys there that you'll have a good idea of that. You know, you didn't get that with the 168 version because all those guys pretty much were jabronis. But I like it better. But back to the original question of, like, is Burchell the number one guy or who is the number one guy? I gun to my head, I'd probably say it's going to be Davis. I think Burchelt is pretty slow. I think Burchelt is open to be countered. I'm not that sold on his power. I know some people, I was talking with Josh, who's someone in the chat. Josh is like, wow, Burchelt's power, and Burchelt does have power, but I'm not sold on it. Like, I don't think that has much influence in his fights against, say, Gervonta Davis. I mean, maybe a guy who's not proven, or at least proven to be not that good in, like, Alberto Machado. But I don't think Burchelt is, you know, I just don't see him as a top guy. He's...
Yeah. I was just going to jump in for a second. I mean, it's funny when you look at, I always like to look at if BoxRec, if you have an account, they'll show the actual like point totals that go into their algorithm or like, it's like the output of their algorithm. And if you look at him, like he's ranked number one at 130 by a lot, but all of the points basically come from the Francisco Vargas fight. Because of some like weird, I don't know, like occasionally their algorithm will just like glitch out. So Burchelt goes from, you know, fighting absolutely no one and having, you know, accumulated very, very few points in BoxRec system. So at that point, when he fights Francisco Vargas coming in, he has 147 points. But then when he fights Francisco Vargas, he somehow comes out with 524 points. Like this giant, I know this is completely ridiculous sounding for someone who doesn't go over these numbers, but somehow Vargas got this like giant, and like if you go back, like how did Vargas get all these points? It was all from beating Juan Manuel Lopez for some reason, even though Lopez had already been knocked out three times at that point. So you sometimes end up with these weird things because they heavily, the points are basically mostly based off of accumulating wins over time. So like if you have a fighter who comes up and fights a lot of like ex-champions on the way up, their points skyrocket because they get all these accumulated points from ex-champions. You don't. It's a lot harder to lose points once you gain them. Anyway, so point being, Miguel Burchelt's entire resume is basically built off of Francisco Vargas win and Takeshi Miro win. And Davis, on the other side, his resume is basically built on having beaten Jose Pedraza and Jesus Cuellar.
Right.
So I personally would rate Jose Pedraza and Jesus Cuellar over the Francisco Vargas Takeshi Miura wins. There's not a lot of overlap between those different resumes, so it's really hard to say, you know, who deserves to be rated higher. But, you know, again, it's just based on the eye test. Definitely rate Gervonta Davis's physical talent and boxing ability higher based on the eye test, and I definitely rate those two wins and the way those two wins looked. I mean, if you look at Burchelt's fight, he got a TKO-3 against Jonathan Victor Barros, you know, who's, you know, at best a serviceable journeyman. Davis, in his last fight, got a similar third-round TKO, but it was against Jesus Cuellar, who, you know, is a former world champion, very respected fighter, had just given Abner Mara's a very good fight the year prior. So, you know, again, it's that's where I'd come in. But Burchelt, again, it's like not to diminish him. You know, he's 26. He has that one loss earlier in his career, but that was really almost a loss you throw out. Like you always talk about, that was a first round knockout. You know, if you just take that off his resume, again, very, very bright young talent in the sport. But I would give the edge to Davis.
I mean, that based off of eye test, I agree. I don't agree with merit. I think the Francisco Vargas fight and the Miura fight rate higher than beating Cuellar, who lost to Abner Mares, who, granted, Mares has made some strides, but at the time, you can only look at what we knew at the time. And at the time, Cuellar was supposed to beat Mares. That was supposed to be a real tough fight for Mares. So Cuellar is just obviously not that good. Has never had a win that you would say that's an above average win. But we have to move on. We're going to end up going super long if we
sure,
talk
go
about
ahead. Yeah, let's keep it going.
Three round fight.
Yeah, this was supposed to be a 30-second topic. Yeah, we'll keep it moving.
We'll save the 30-second spots for the British fighters.
Sure.
So Clarissa Shields fights Hannah Gabriels and she wins. And now it looks like all signs are pointing to the Christina Hammer fight. Now, I don't want this to sound like it's criticism, what I'm about to say, because it's really not. I don't even know if I should even be prefacing it, because I don't know. What I will say is that Clarissa Shields is really talented. Like, you can clearly tell she's a level above most female fighters because of her just raw athleticism and her explosiveness. She clearly has a gear that most female fighters that we see, at least, obviously we don't see a ton of female fighters because that's just the nature of the sport. This isn't the UFC, but she clearly looks like she has a gear that nobody else has. And I think I'm not alone in saying that you don't care who the opponent is, you're not picking against Clarissa Shields. Whether that's ignorance or whether you're actually impressed with how she's fought in her time in the spotlight on Showtime. But what I will say is that I'm very confident that Shields is beatable. And I think for sure that hammer fight is maybe 60-40 for Shields. Like, that's not a fight that I see her just blitzing through. I think the change in weight had an effect on her ability to take punches and in turn messed up her defense, although her defense isn't good. I think that's something that's been consistent in every single fight is that Shields basically is like, if you were playing Fight Night and you used the highest rated character and you went against the lowest rated character, and you're like, you could just stand there and just mash buttons because at some point you'll hurt them or they'll gas out, but you have them beat, so you can just do whatever. So it's your classic, I don't want to call her a bully, but your classic, like, super athletic fighter that can get by without doing the fundamental stuff or being as responsible for defense as possible, or that they could be because they know they're going to win. And I don't think that that's the case anymore. I think at 160, Shields is a very different fighter that needs to bring or take a step away from that, like, all action style that she's fighting in at the moment. And that's really all I have to say. Maybe the other thing I can say is that this hammer fight legitimately will be a big deal. I think they could put this on a Saturday night. I mean, if they put a decent undercard on, and I don't trust that Demetrius Salida has the pull to put on a good undercard, but if they put on or even as a co-main event, like, I know it's like they probably would rather be a main event than be the co-main on, say a Jermell Charlo fight or something, or that Benavidez Durrell fight that we'll talk about in a little bit. But I think they'd rather just go solo, and while it won't do as good of a number, it'll still do way better than for sure that Brakus fight. Anything you want to say on it?
Yeah, I'll try to be quick, but I mean, this was definitely the most interesting card for me this weekend. My wife and I always enjoy watching Clarissa Shields fights, and it's been really fun seeing Showtime build the Christina Hammer Clarissa Shields like rivalry. Like, Christina Hammer, I think going back two fights ago, watched one of her fights, and they did like an interview with her, did a segment. they kind of got into it after Shields' last fight. Like, Hammer was supposed to fight on the card, and then she dropped off, and they had some jawing at each other. And then this one, I mean, if you haven't seen the clip, look it up online. Like, Shields really called Hammer out aggressively after the fight. I mean, really, just like, clearly, like, some social media stuff had gotten to her, and she was really eager to get in her face after the fight. So,
Well, punches were thrown.
yeah, I mean, it was it's like she had the Durrell family in her corner.
Oh,
And it
you
looked
don't.
like it.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, Shields, like, famously after the uncle threw the sucker punch, was like on social media defending him, saying like, "Good job, Unc." Like, I think that was the quote. Yeah, you gotta stick up for your guy. So she's got some fight in her, which is fun. I mean, it definitely adds something to these broadcasts. So yeah, I mean, just about the fight, like, I think this was definitely Shields' best performance. She got knocked down in the first round, like you said, could have had something to do with going down in weight, sort of having to adjust from that, or durability being impacted. But this is by far her best performance, and it was against by far her best opponent. So she was fighting an opponent who was a unified champion at 154. She was a unified champion at 168 coming down. They met at 160 and fought for two belts at 160. So Shields instantly now became a unified champion in the second weight class that she's fought in. It was interesting because seeing Gabriel's, again, definitely like the best opponent that we've seen her in with, and this is something you see with male fighters as well. Like, when you see a really schooled amateur come up, sometimes you don't see their whole tool set when they're against a lower level of competition. And it was interesting to see, like, Shields had been so dominant at the Olympics. She won the Val Barker Trophy on the female side in 2016. Those of you who don't know, that's, you know, the prize awarded to the overall top fighter. Yeah, well, so Roy Jones won it famously. So did Lomachenko. So, I mean, it's not just that Shields won two Olympic gold medals. Like, really? I don't know.
No, are you kidding me?
No, I just laugh because I was thinking, I know about Lomachenko and Roy Jones, but I don't know the other people that have won it. You know, so I'm guessing it's people who really did not go on. Yeah, I think actually Vasily Girov did, who had that really memorable fight with James Toney, but otherwise his pro career didn't really pan out that well. But anyway, yeah, she was considered the super dominant amateur. And I think people who've seen her as a pro really kind of question that, because she's had some ugly fights and people kind of wondered, you know, is this the opponent she was in with? Is this adjusting to the pro game? And I think in this fight, you really got to see why she did well at the Olympics, like for better or worse. You got to see why she did well at the Olympics, because like what Olympic style boxing, especially on the female side, ends up being is like a lot of exchanges with a lot of punches thrown. And what you saw in this fight was, you know, she would get in these exchanges and they would throw a lot of punches. Some would miss, some wouldn't. She would get touched sometimes, but it was consistently, you know, if there were three, like four punches landed, she'd land three good punches, her opponent would land one good punch, and then maybe there'd be some glancing blows. And that was kind of the story of the whole fight after the first round. You know, there would be lots of exchanges, and she would throw the shorter, crisper shots and always get the better of it. And definitely from pretty early on, she had Gabriel's reluctant to exchange and back off. I mean, I think definitely her power and strength. And also, again, just, you know, the confidence that when those exchanges happened, Shields was going to be the one getting the better of it. So I think this, you know, I think people from the outside remember this is the fight where she got knocked down. But to me, as someone who's seen, you know, all of her fights, I think her first fight, they just showed some footage on that Word Kovalev broadcast. But I've seen all of the footage that's out there of all of her pro fights. And to me, this is really the fight where Clarissa Shields came into her own. I was very impressed. So regarding Christina Hammer, though, to touch on her quickly, she was fighting Tori Nelson, who had fought Clarissa Shields previously, and Hammer looked great and had a completely different style. She, you know, really boxed, fought with an just more straight up style, lots of jabs and you know, straights, you know, a lot of 1-2s, and really looked impressive. I mean, it was just a very different style from Clarissa Shields. So to get back to what you were saying, like if they fought, you would favor Shields, but like a 60-40, I definitely agree with that. And yeah, as high as I am on Shields, I think Hammer is like a perfect counterpoint, and they've had this great animosity. So yeah, as far as where it happens, that's really where it gets difficult. I don't know if we've really talked about this on the podcast, but I've been a fan forever of Showbox. Like Showbox to me has consistently really great matchmaking. Lots of future champions have come up through there, and they're always matched tough when they're, you know, every fighter is on Showbox is matched up.
Yeah, Showbox doesn't put on showcase fights.
Right. I mean, they always matter. They're always relevant to the progression of these fighters' careers. Again, you look at Shields, like, you know, she's fighting for two title belts here. And, you know, again, like Christina Hammer is fighting Tori Nelson, who is one of Shields' tougher fights up to that point, you know, fighting that opponent. Like they aren't putting on showcases. But that's the thing, though. It's like Showbox, like, so I've tried to ask like Steven Espinoza about that sort of. I'm always kind of curious because it's like they don't really do that much media. It doesn't get much media coverage. They don't do that much promotion for it. And it really is like within Showtime treated as like a separate entity. So I think it will be pretty hard to bridge the gap between like a Showbox Clarissa Shield card and trying to do like you were saying, a Saturday night or having like a fuller broadcast. Like you have Demetrius Salida. This is not like a PBC associated thing. So yeah, just to finish off the point, I don't, you know, I think this might end up being on Showbox, and that could be if they're trying to build this bigger fight with Christina Hammer, you know, that fight might be bigger than that venue. And then if, you know, it doesn't fit on Showbox, I don't know if they can make it happen, but we'll see. It'll be interesting to see if they have the money and the budget to do that.
So I'm going to, this is a good transition point. I'm going to go out of order because I didn't intend to talk about this right now, but Martin Murray fought Roberto Garcia, and I'm going to steal a line from the producer of this show who laughed to me and said that Clarissa Shields sold more tickets than Martin Murray did, because the arena for the Martin Murray versus Roberto Garcia fight was, I mean, there's like empty, like they didn't sell a lot of tickets here. And then there's like This is kind of embarrassing. Like, why, first of all, why is this on TV? Because the fight was completely just pathetic. And then secondly, you're making me feel bad seeing all these empty chairs. Like, there's empty chairs ringside. Usually ringside is sold out for the most part. It doesn't matter where the fight is. You can just get people to get those ringside seats. But the arena was just embarrassingly empty. And the fight, on the other hand, I mean, like, seriously, boxing probably is going to be a topic in the British government politics. Like, because if you watch this fight, you're just like, wow, I don't know if I want to watch this sport anymore. It was that bad. I mean, in the first round, I'm in the chat. Rollins says to me, they're going to take a point off of Garcia. I can already tell. And I was like, really? I was like, okay. And then literally second round, was it the second round? He take a point.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, oh, God. He's like, I called it. And I'm like, wow, this is going to be bad. And so we had the rest of the fight happen, which was really horrible. And I'm not going to talk about Martin Marie. Sergio Mora had a good tweet at Roberto Garcia, I think it was. He told him on Twitter that if you want to fight Martin Murray, you better bring your own judges. Because that was some pretty poor judging. But at the same time, were those judges even watching the fight? Maybe not. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to, because there's worse cards to talk about, I think.
Yeah, my very, very, very quick take on this card. I mean, I feel like this was a card which was more about the undercard than the main event. Like, they needed to have the main event to put the event on, but...
Yeah, save the undercards. We'll talk about all of them at the same time.
Oh, you want to get back to it later?
Yeah.
Okay, go on then.
Oh, no, I mean, if you have any other takes on this particular fight, I can't imagine you would, but if you did...
No, I just... Roberto Garcia is sort of a notorious figure because he was supposed to fight Sean Porter a few years ago, dropped out of that fight. Then he was supposed to fight Errol Spence, dropped out of that fight. Then just kind of, like, disappeared. Like, he was supposed to be in the PBC universe. They were actually, like, promoting him. Yeah. There was this whole big feature on him. They had this show called... I don't remember what it was called, like Toe to Toe or something like that. So they did almost like this whole 24/7 special on him because he was going to have these big fights at welterweight. And then he just like totally melted down and dropped off the scene.
Because he can't pass medicals. That's why. That's why he's fighting in the UK.
It's crazy to see. Yeah, I mean, now why is he in 2018 considered, you know, a reasonable opponent for someone who's claiming to be in the top 10 at 160?
When he's a career 147-pound fighter?
Yeah, exactly. Like, no version of this makes sense.
Look, Martin Murray is completely done. I'm sure he's a nice guy, but he's done. Like, this... I mean, he is the silver champion, though, after all. So, and Eddie Hearn did a real good job convincing people... No, it wasn't Eddie Hearn. Oh, no, wait. Eddie Hearn did promote a silver belt fight. Not this one, but Eddie Hearn with Dillian Whyte said some stuff about how, you know, this is the silver title, so it means something. And Bob Arum said, get this shit out of here because I won't promote that any fight for a silver title. But anyway, yeah, let's move on to the other British card, which is Josh Taylor versus Victor Postol. All in all, I thought it was a really good fight. Very entertaining. The cards were off, and I'll say the same thing I say anytime we have a fight like this. It wasn't a robbery, not like a blatant robbery. You could say maybe it's a robbery because it was completely not aligned with what you thought. But I can see the argument for, you know, a fairly wide Josh Taylor score. I can see it. Now, I don't agree with it, but I can see that. And I'm not going to say, like, you know, Shane McGugan or Barry McGugan, they bought off the judges because... I'm sure that all the money that they're stealing from Josh Taylor, they're just keeping to themselves. So why would they spend any money on him and buy off the judges? He doesn't need it. I think literally this is just a case of the crowd was wild for Taylor and maybe the refs were or the judges were a little influenced. Postol, by the way, doesn't do himself any favors, though, because if you watch a Victor Postol fight and you can go back throughout his career, he never looks like he's 100% in control. He always, except maybe for the Matisse fight, he always looks like he's a few steps away, or sorry, not a few steps, but a few punches away from going down at some point. It's just, you know, he's a skinny, lanky guy. It's not his fault. It's just the way his body's made. But I'm pretty sure a bug flew into my mouth.
Oh, God.
Wow. But where does Josh Taylor rank at 140?
We'll move on, I guess. But, you know, yeah, very, very quick thoughts on this. Where does he rank? I think he's in the top five. I think he's already gotten to that point, arguably top two, which is, you know, pretty impressive that at this point in his career, he's really already, you know, leapt up to that level. I get your point about the scoring. I mean, it seemed a little bit wide, but at the same time, someone who scored fights ringside, it's like sometimes rounds can be competitive and you just end up favoring. There's just one fighter that you just prefer the work they're doing. So it's like you recognize that it's competitive, but you just feel like they keep edging out all of the rounds. So, yeah, you know, it's hometown. Maybe it was a little bit sketchy, but it's not completely insane scores. He did get the knockdown, albeit later in the fight. But, you know, if the judges had the perception, we've talked about this before, the perception can change ringside, that one fighter's landing heavier shots. You know, yeah, maybe they were right if, you know, again, he was the guy in the end who scored the knockdown. Yeah, it's interesting for a few levels. I mean, one, it will be interesting to see if he enters the World Boxing Super Series. It's starting to feel like a two-man division with Josh Taylor and Regis Progre.
Tom, don't do that.
Who are you ranking up there too? Terry Flanagan?
Well, first of all, Terry Flanagan just got beat, so it wouldn't be him. It would be Jose Ramirez.
Oh, come on.
You cannot sit here and tell me that that Taylor and Progre are both...
BoxRec has Ramirez number 19. Because there is not a single significant win on his resume.
BoxRec can do whatever it wants, but it's still lists Manny Pacquiao as a top guy in the world of boxing.
There's no argument there to get Jose Ramirez.
Ramirez is up there. He's up there in this conversation. You cannot say that Regis Progre has beaten anybody apart from, like, you can't say he beat Ndongo and that was great. I mean, really, Ndongo didn't look good in that fight. He looked worse than Victor Pulso did in the Josh Taylor fight.
He also beat Joel Diaz Jr., another prospect.
I mean, I'm not saying that Progre is no good or Josh Taylor's not that good. I'm just saying that this division may look like it's going to get top heavy real quick, but the contenders or the guys who are possibly in that conversation is not just Josh Taylor. And I actually don't think it's Josh Taylor. His performance in this fight wasn't great. Victor Postol old manned him for many rounds in the fight. And you know, the last British prospect we saw get old manned was Huey Fury. And we saw how that turned out.
That's a very interesting name to draw into this.
So, I mean, Josh Taylor, don't get me wrong. He's a talented fighter. He's a talented fighter. But so is Luke Campbell, and there's a lot of similarities between the two of them. It will be interesting to see how Josh Taylor actually performs against a real 140-pound contender, because obviously Victor Postol is not that at this point in his career. But... I do think that the division is getting top heavy. I'll agree with you there, but Jose Ramirez is in the conversation.
I mean, he will be just by nature of him being on ESPN and having a big promoter behind him. He also is a big ticket seller, so credit him for that. I really don't see it there in his performances and in his resume. I don't think he's done anything to, like, you know, we were talking about how tough people get, matched on Showbox. Regis Progre came through that gauntlet. He fought on Showbox about four times, always with tough level of competition for that level of his career. I just have so much more respect for what he's done than what Jose Ramirez has done. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Hopefully we'll get to see those fights happen. I mean, theoretically, there's supposed to be like a mini tournament happening, like a mini eliminator happening where Regis Progre and Jose Ramirez are supposed to fight, but it's hard to believe Bob Arum will actually let that happen.
Okay, moving on.
Yes,
not going to stay in this. So we had a slew of prospects in action. We saw Tony Yoka stop Dave Allen. Virgil Ortiz, he knocks out Juan Carlos Salgado. Daniel Dubois stopped his guy. Anthony Yard stopped this random guy that they pulled in off the street. Although Virgil Ortiz's opponent, was it Virgil Ortiz? No, it was one of the guys on the undercard of that fight. literally looked like they found some guy who was like, yeah, I'm game, I'll fight, like from the crowd. Literally looked like that. So these guys all win. None of them are were obviously in the ring with anybody that's worthwhile. I mean, you could make an argument that Dave Allen was worthwhile, but then you, if you actually saw his performance and you're still saying that, then you're delusional. So who has the highest ceiling?
That's a question to me out of all these undercard guys. Yeah. I mean, I was just going to draw the same conclusion that you did. I mean, that was really the point I was going to get to. I mean, was that none of these guys were in tough. I mean, really, like, so soft that these wins don't mean anything. Like, if you look at Virgil Ortiz's opponent, I mean, what are we possibly supposed to learn from that? You know, and same thing on the other side, looking at Dubois and Yard. I mean, I guess that's the funny thing. Like, the Allen is probably the most kind of seasoned, you'd think, recognizable guy out of that entire pool of opponents. But Yoka didn't look super great in that fight either. You know, it's like you'd think if he's supposed to be a future player, a future top five heavyweight, future credible threat to Anthony Joshua or Deontay Wilder. I mean, he certainly didn't look like that. He looks like he has a ways to go. O'Hara Davies, I mean, I'll just finish with this, had by far the craziest dramatic knockdown of the weekend. Just hit the guy with a right and just Tim Burr just toppled over. I don't know your thoughts. I mean, did any of these wins mean anything to you this weekend?
Well, they didn't mean anything, but my question is who has the highest ceiling? So, you know, you can project a little, you can kind of, how do you see their careers playing out? Now, you pointed to Tony Yoka that even top five might be tough for him. I think Dubois looked far better than Anthony Yard. I think Anthony Yard is clearly very poor at boxing. I know that he's, I mean, think about it. I've said this many, many times in the past on the podcast, but when guys are presented with opportunities and they don't take them, there's that's an indication to you that their camp knows something. When you turn down two title fights, I mean, just think about it. Like, what are you communicating? Oh, we're not ready for this. We don't want this. That's it. And they know at this point that Yard would get smoked if he got in the ring with even the weakest of title holders at 175, like an Archer Beterbiev. So Dubois looked far better than him, but Dubois also is really slow. I like what he can do, but I'm not really sold on him as a heavyweight. I think there's just still a lot of holes. Also, Anthony Yard is 27 years old. He's 27 years old, and he's not fighting anyone, turning down title opportunities. And then just to throw Josh Taylor into this, because Josh Taylor is technically still a prospect too, Josh Taylor is 29. You know who's the other 29-year-old prospect who ended up getting beat, who's a southpaw, British, tall, lanky? Oh, yeah, Luke Campbell. So just throwing that out there. Also, you may remember Luke Campbell, one of my favorite fighters, so don't even try down that road, okay? I still love him. But so then that brings us to Virgil Ortiz. Does he have a high ceiling? I don't think so. Now, he can do a lot, and I would say that the floor is higher for him than anyone else. Like, he just has... You could see in Ortiz a lot of what typically works in the sport of boxing. You see, like, okay, very good body work, throws in combination. He places his punches pretty well. Okay, that's not bad. I could see this guy having success in the future as in boxing. And clearly looks like he's got power. No fights gone past three. Yeah, it looks like he's got a good personality, that he's outgoing, that he's going to get people invested in him. And he fights at a division where he brings a style that isn't quite, there's really nobody that has a style at 140, unless we're going to consider Adrian Granados in the division, but he brings a typical Mexican style to 140, which if you look at the top guys at 140, nobody's really fighting that way. So I think the floor is highest with Ortiz. Just basically he's followed a formula that's worked for a long time. I mean, the highest ceiling, I think, is Tony Yoka. I think there's enough there that if it all comes together, it might be a great combination. But he's like a super high risk, high reward sort of thing. Like, I don't think he pans out. If he does pan out, he'll pan out in the best way possible. And that's what I have to say about the prospects from this weekend, because otherwise I wasn't that impressed in what they accomplished. They're prospects who did their prospect duty by beating up guys that they put in front of them. Except for Yard, who went way too long with a guy with very basic movement. I thought Yard probably looked the worst out of all of them. Anything else you want to say?
Yeah, just very quickly. I mean, Yoka, if he does even half of what he's supposed to do, he'll be able to line up a huge... I mean, he's an Olympic gold medal winner, super heavyweight division. You'd have to think at some point down the line there would be a fight between him and Joshua if he can just avoid getting knocked out by a lower level of competition. So in terms of money making, you know, there's a ceiling there. I'm not seeing it in the ability necessarily. And just regarding Ortiz, I mean, just to point something out, like, I always get a little frustrated. You know, it's like he looks good and, you know, people are saying, oh, he has power. His level of opposition has been so limited. And, you know, I won't even criticize him because he's 20, but it's just, it's so premature to get excited about anything. I was just looking up, you know, just to illustrate a point. So in this fight, fought Juan Carlos Salgado, 27-8. You know, that's by far his best opponent, a guy with 8 losses, a bunch of knockouts on his record.
10 fights, so just, though.
What?
Ortiz only has 10 fights.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying again, it's like, I'm not even going to criticize this because he's so young. I'm just pointing out like how hard it is to extrapolate what we should learn from this. So Salgado, you know, again, it's like we consider him now, he's an opponent. This is kind of a joke fight for Ortiz to take. He went 21-0 before he got his first loss. So he got all the way up to 21-0 before he lost. You know, that says something. You know, it's like if you are fighting absolutely nothing competition, you know, guys who are 7-5, guys who are 3-5, those wins really don't mean anything. I mean, you're saying, you know, oh, it looks like he has power. It looks like he's putting his punches together. I mean, you really can't even judge that because it's so hard to extrapolate what that would mean on the world level when you're seeing them in with this level. But yeah, again, he's 20. I mean, nothing to criticize, only has 10 fights. But it's just when you ask the ceiling question, these opponents this weekend were so bad. I just, you know, I sort of gristle at the premise of the question.
Yeah, well, you just discounted 3/4 of Deontay Wilder's career.
Well, and that's why people, I think, rightly criticized him until he, you know, he went up just, you know, really hard to see where he would go. And then once he did step up, you know, started to legitimize that.
All right, let's move on. So since I already brought up Deontay Wilder, Anthony Joshua, so Eddie Hearn sends over a contract to Wilder. Wilder hasn't responded yet. Or, well, just follow the story for storyline purposes. And then Eddie Hearn comes out and says that Wilder clearly doesn't want the fight because he hasn't responded to our contract offer. But actually, Wilder did talk, and he gave an interview, and he talked about the negotiation and, you know, all this stuff. He says... So let's just read the quotes, okay? This is to the World Boxing News. Finkel told the World Boxing News, "We looked at the contract on Monday and raised 2 specific details in the paperwork that we needed clarification of. It's frustrating as Eddie is stating in the media that we need to be quick and sign the contract, but how can we sign if they don't respond to our email and clarify our concerns? If we're being rushed, we really need to hear back from Barry, Eddie's daddy, in order to be able to complete things on our side. Eddie sent us a response, which we will respond to next week." So then Wilder says, "It's clear to see that they don't want to fight me. Every time they come with something, I've agreed to everything, and they haven't agreed to anything. If he fights Povetkin, then he's completely ducked. Eddie is a manipulator, contradictor, and a compulsive liar. If anybody can't identify a snake, that's the one you have to practice on. Why the F don't you make the fight? If I fought bums all my career, why do you need more than 8 weeks to prepare for a bum like me? All the things they've put me through, I can't wait. I'm going to take Eddie's head and stick it in Joshua's body." Which, if you really think about that, was unnecessary to say. I'm just going to let you think of the visual. I'll say it again. "I'm going to take Eddie's head and stick it on..." Oh, it's actually on Joshua's body, not in Joshua's body. All right, never mind. Take it back. but that was in an interview with Behind the Gloves. So let's see. I don't know if I've said this in the past, but I just think that I really like Eddie Hearn because he's so good at playing this game. He just, and I made this in a comment today on Reddit, but basically it's like Eddie knows how to play the media. He knows who to talk to. He knows what to say. He knows when to say it so that basically his narrative, what he wants out there, is the prevailing narrative amongst boxing fans. He gets to everybody first. Those people on the fence, they're quickly brought over to his side because he's the first one that spoke. So clearly he's the one that's right. And then everyone, and then Joshua, or not Joshua, but Wilder is the one who has to swim upstream and win everyone back over to his side. Now, the funny thing is, none of this matters because this does not control the negotiation. Actual data, numbers, not what idiots on Reddit and Twitter like me think. Interesting dynamic here. I mean, I don't know where to go with this. Like, we've done the conversation to death of, like, is this fight
going
to happen?
Yeah, really. I'm, like, straining to think what I'll even respond to here.
Yeah, so if you got anything to say about this other than some obvious stuff,
yeah, I can just put a capper on the side. I mean, you know, it's like Eddie Hearn comes out with a quote, I won't let Joshua face Wilder with an 8-week camp, that you had mentioned Wilder's response in there. We've talked about this. It's like, this fight is not happening. They've really just kind of tried to stall this out, and I think fans have kind of lost interest at this point to some extent. I mean, this was a piping hot issue a few weeks ago. Now fans are just like, come on, we know the fight's not happening. Just announce the real fights you're going to do. Let's just get on with it. And, you know, I think by reaching that point, Hearn has won. You know, the fight has not happened. He hasn't damaged Joshua's brand image, at least not heavily. You know, some fans are going to say he was ducking, that Wilder is the one who really wanted the fight. I think most reasonable people will say that Wilder wanted the fight and that Hearn and Joshua turned it down for business reasons. But, you know, regardless of what the takeaway, looks like it's never looked more like the fight is not going to happen. And it's, you know, again, Hearn has just succeeded in kind of just tamping down on all that excitement. So, yeah, that's all I have to say about that.
Well, Hearn's done such a beautiful job. Really building up Joshua amongst the British casual fans. I mean, there's this, like, I don't know what you would call it, but I guess a euphemism, maybe, of British fans calling it Matchroom FC because of how much the Matchroom fans in the UK resemble basically, like, the soccer hooligans or something. I think that's Babs's line. This isn't the best person to be quoting right now because Babs is completely anti-Matchroom, but there's some merit there. You know, obviously every fan base has those, how should we classify them, as extremely devoted, who are unwilling to listen to any reason. And Hearn's done a really good job building up a sizable fan base of that variety for Joshua. So we can move on. Canelo has said, and this is partly why the Wilder Joshua is kind of like reached its exhaustion point, is because the Canelo Golovkin thing is just burying us every single day. And I mean, if you want to add the Matisse Pacquiao drama to this, we just have three fights that feature very, very big names in the sport. And it's like every day it seems like we're getting news that something's not happening, or it's messed up, or whatever. But Canelo's not going to do any press for this fight with Golovkin. What's your take on that? I think if I made my take public, you would know better than me.
Yeah, go on. I mean, that's something. Sometimes this stuff gets lost in the daily pods. I mean, some of this stuff is worth sharing on the weekly. So yeah, please go ahead.
Well,
I just
don't know if I say things or not because I don't want to repeat myself. But I'll just quickly
say.
No.
You didn't. I don't think you talked about it on the weekly for sure. So yeah, please, because this is kind of a thing that broke in the past week of Canelo coming out and saying he wasn't going to do the press.
Okay. Well, my general take is basically that maybe HBO doesn't have the money. It's maybe that simple, that they don't want to pay, or maybe the sponsors don't want to pay for the press stuff. Maybe the fight sells itself. You wrote on the thing about something that I should probably share that I'm not sure I want to. So I'll hear what you have to say on this, and then I'll see what I want to say.
Well, I'm just gonna jump ahead and just bring that up. I mean, you know, this is something in air quotes we call this a conspiracy theory. Well, I mean, okay, so one of our favorite contributors, Fred I guess it emailed you. And anyway, there's sort of a behind-the-scenes story about this. But yeah, I'll just paraphrase what he said. I don't think it's that crazy of a conspiracy theory. But basically, Canelo didn't want to do any press for the fight because he feels Triple G got way too generous of a split, that he's the big draw. Triple G's getting way too much money. He doesn't like that Triple G is making money off of his name, which I think we would agree with that. I mean, Canelo is bringing, you know, there are varying reasons why Canelo would take the fight, wouldn't take the fight, would want the split that they got, you know, whether why he would accept it, why he wouldn't. But without question, Canelo is the one who's bringing money to this promotion. So I think Canelo sees this is going to be by far the biggest payday of Triple G's career. He's not going to extend his brand to try to make Triple G more money. And I would also just add, I mean, my take on this, that was Fred's comments. This is now my comments. If Canelo is worried that he's going to lose or there's a risk of not looking good in this fight and he just knows he needs to get past it because of the controversy from the scorecard in the first fight and because of the clenbuterol test, so he needs to just, you know, close this chapter and then move on with the rest of his career. You know, if he's worried he's not going to look good or that he's going to lose, he doesn't really need to put a giant spotlight on this. I mean, I think Canelo feels there's more to his career than fighting Triple G. He doesn't need to, you know, where conversely, this will be the biggest moment of Triple G's career, at least Triple G's remaining career with his age. I mean, Triple G could even retire after this fight, potentially.
I think he's going to retire.
Well, you can pick up right there. That was really just my comment. As far as it's an interesting topic. I don't have the answer, but it is interesting. Again, Canelo refusing the press tour. My one last comment. I actually talked to Keith Idick about this at the Errol Spence press event. I guess we might talk about that later. But we were sort of talking about it. It was kind of like the big topic of that day, and. The other thing I raised was the question if this has, again, to do with the drug testing stuff. Canelo has not wanted to answer questions about this. From our perspective, we've talked about this before, Canelo really doesn't have that much to apologize for. The clenbuterol thing and the beef seems reasonably plausible. He took the hair follicle test. That didn't seem to indicate further drug test problems. He's now agreed to this more advanced drug testing, this more invasive level of drug testing leading up to the rematch. So, I mean, from my perspective, he's answered all the questions, but I think he doesn't want to do a press tour where every question is going to be about drug testing, or maybe he has the worry that could just come up and just be, you know, too unpleasant for him, too damaging to his brand. Anyway, yeah, back to you. So I'm curious, if nothing else, to hear your comment about Triple G retiring.
Well, I think that the money that he's gotten, because obviously Oscar's paying out of pocket to convince Golovkin to sign
for which is
the
crazy
42%. Here's the thing. I have a couple of points that I'll just quickly make. One, this is why Eddie Hearn is such a good promoter. Eddie, do you think for a second that if we replaced Joshua with Canelo, that you would be sitting here having this conversation about, well, Canelo's a cheater and that they bought the judges? You wouldn't. Eddie Hearn would have been all over that story, and he would have gotten the story out quick enough to convince enough people that whether you're spitting the truth, throwing out facts, the Matchroom fan base, the Joshua fan base would drown you out. And that's what's happened right here, is K2's been able to win that battle. But basically the social media battle, because that's really what we're talking about, is the whether or not you can win on the social media front. Because, I mean, my question is whether or not that matters or not. I don't think it does. Maybe it does. I don't know. More. Obviously, I don't have the evidence or the research, and I don't know how to do the research. I'll figure out something, some way, somehow. But that's one aspect of it. The second aspect is one of the things that's just not being discussed enough about this. By the way, if you really like this subject, you should subscribe on Patreon, because I talk about this a lot, or at least I have in the past, and you can just go back and listen to all the podcasts on this, basically everyday discussion. But Canelo got knee surgery, and in the pictures that have been released and the Instagram videos that have been released, he's still in his little knee brace. Okay, I don't. like, we know that it's a legit shoulder, or sorry, not shoulder. You can probably get where I'm going with this, but we know that's a legit knee injury because we've seen the pictures and stuff. We've seen that there's like kind of evidence from doctors, unlike with Manny Pacquiao and his shoulder surgery that supposedly happened. Or, you know, you can look at Lomachenko, who posted obvious proof that he had some sort of shoulder problem or injury that got fixed. But that's a subject that needs to be discussed. But the only way it's going to get discussed is if we can ignore all this stupid stuff that's going on with K2, the clenbuterol, all the stuff. But Canelo's maybe... Are we sure he's going to come into this fight 100%? I don't know.
I'll be tuning in. I'll be fascinated. I think at the end of the day, it's going to look like the first fight did. But, you know, there's certainly room for a lot of speculation here. But, yeah, this is as much as I have to say about it. I feel like somehow every week we find, you know, way too much time to spend talking about this fight.
Well, I mean, this is the – so, you know, ESPN doesn't not talk about LeBron because they talk about him every day. I just – maybe Canelo just didn't want to deal with all the harassment he would be getting for the next couple of months doing the preparation for the fight in the press. Maybe just like, whatever, say what you guys want. When I beat him, hopefully this all blows over. But, I mean, Canelo's a very prideful guy. I'm sure his feelings are hurt about this. And I am not even joking. I legitimately mean I'm pretty sure his feelings are a little hurt about this. Now, obviously he channels that into, like, being pissed off and I want to knock – Golovkin out, but like his feelings are probably hurt. We can move on to David Benavidez, who will be fighting Anthony Durrell. Is there any news about where this will be happening?
Yeah, I put this on the show notes. I mean, it's an interesting topic to me just because like earlier in the week, I had asked Steven Espinoza about it. See on our YouTube channel, I have an interview with Steven Espinoza from the Earl Spence Media event. And it was kind of interesting. Like, he had said before David Benavidez settled his lawsuit with Top Rank and that whole situation that David Benavidez would be back on Showtime sooner than later. Basically, he knew the behind-the-scenes details and felt that confident that David Benavidez was not going to end up with ESPN, that he was going to be back on Showtime. And sure enough, that news was announced pretty shortly after that. But when I asked him if he was going to be back, because he was originally supposed to be on the Mikey Garcia undercard, which is, in LA, it's Mikey Garcia, it's a great Mexican fan base. You'd think there'd be like a lot of great synergy there. You've mentioned that Mikey Garcia is not that huge of a draw, but you get David Benavidez on there, you'd think that would be a really great pairing. He indicated that David Benavidez needed more time to come back, mentioned that there were some training issues as well, like he hasn't been training actively for a fight since this contract dispute has come up. So I was very surprised very shortly after that. Yeah, not a good sign. Right, but
especially with his brother.
I don't know where you're going with that, but
dude, his brother got shot and was out of the ring for a while. You think that's like because he was just casually strolling around West Hall?
You're saying has West too LA. Much free time on his hands, getting in trouble. Yeah. David Benavidez, though, is conversely known for being like a gym rat. Like, there are videos online where Abel Sanchez has talked very highly of him the time that he spent in camp with Triple G. And kind of weird. So I was very surprised, like, only like 2 days later, this news came out that he was fighting Anthony Durrell in September. It's also strange because there's no card announced for that time. So kind of unclear what card that even is, if it would be a main event or an undercard. Just a little bit strange. And also just to add, talk about this previewing for next weekend. Anthony Durrell, I think, pretty tough fight for Benavidez. Like, Durrell is, I think, doesn't get a lot of respect among boxing fans for both, in-ring and out-of-ring reasons and just being part of the Durrell family. But, I definitely don't think Benavidez will get the knockout. I think that will be a competitive fight. Durrell is somewhere in the top 10 at 168 in my book. So, it should be pretty tough, good fight for him. Like, I thought they were each going to have another fight in between. I know Durrell had been named his mandatory, but Benavidez was originally supposed to fight, I forget the guy's name, Andy Lee fought him at 160.
Matt Korobov?
Yeah, Matt Corvo. He was originally supposed to fight Matt Corvo on July 28th. So it's kind of an interesting turn. So just interesting to see how this shakes out. Yeah, I think that'll be a good fight when it happens. But there are some like other pieces of this announcement which are a little bit strange, and also a little bit strange based on what Steven Espinoza had told me about Benavidez and his current situation. So yeah, we'll see how it shakes out. This is another topic where it's like I don't really have a clear answer. It's just there might be more to this story. There might be some more interesting stuff to come out about this later.
Yeah, I mean, I really like this fight for Benavidez specifically because Anthony Durrell, like you said, is a guy who's a little underrated. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that Durrell is like super good because obviously we would all know that I'm lying. But is he really tough? Does he have a style that's going to make things incredibly difficult for Benavidez? Yeah, I think so. I've met both of these guys and stood next to them. And I can tell you right now that Durrell is perhaps the most physically imposing fighter that I've met.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's just like, it's odd. He doesn't come off as big as he does on TV as he is in person. Like most fighters that I've met, and you probably can attest to this, they're pretty skinny guys. Like, they're usually like, you know, obviously they look like they're in shape, but they're skinny because, you know, you have to be that kind of small to, or at least kind of thinned out to be fighting professionally. You know, you can't walk around at 212 and at 5'9 or whatever.
Yeah, so, yeah, right. Just compared to like a normal person, like a boxer is like usually pretty thin on their frame.
Durrell is huge. Like, so when I saw Durrell, he was standing next to Meta World Peace, aka Ron Artest, aka NBA champion for the LA Lakers, my hometown team. So Ron Artest, if we just Google him real quick, okay? So this guy plays in the NBA. And Ron Artest is known as being an athletic freak in the gym all the time. I mean, look up a picture of him. This dude is built, okay? He's 6'7". Durrell looked maybe a couple inches shorter than him. So maybe they're lying about Artest, but Artest is not a professional basketball player anymore. So this is a normal guy who was bulky as a player and now is no longer playing professional basketball. Durrell was more imposing than him. Like, it's just kind of odd how big he is. So, like, when I imagine these two guys in the ring, I'm not convinced that this is going to be an easy fight for Benavidez unless Durrell's completely shot. So I think this is going to be one of the more interesting fights on the schedule. And I'm real interested to see what happens in this one. I think Benavidez is going to really have to show something in order to win this fight. And that'll be good because obviously everyone believes that Benavidez has a very bright future in the sport. Perhaps as the next like Mexican star. Just in case it comes off, like Durrell was wearing clothes. Okay, don't even go there. Like, maybe he wasn't completely in shape. I don't know, but he just did. Of all the boxers that were there, he did not look like he was a boxer. I'll say that. We can move on. You wanted to talk about Spence, so let's talk about Spence.
Sure. You want me to go on that?
Yeah.
So, yeah, just quick hits here. I told you more about this before we got on. I don't need to give all the details in the podcast. But Errol Spence took a swing through New York, visited a bunch of media spots. I was very fortunate to be in the room with a lot of the basically the boxing press stop. Like, he did ESPN and Stephen A. Smith's radio show, but I was in the room with the boxing press and a bunch of Showtime executives. Yeah, it was a very cool event. Good to talk to him. He's getting like so much better on the mic, by the way. I have to say, from having like talked to him earlier in his career, he's getting much better with that. So just a few like quick hits from this event. Like, small update on Keith Thurman. I was able to talk to Steven Espinoza about that. And he indicated Keith Thurman will probably fight on one of those smaller PBC cards before coming back to Showtime. Like, PBC still has those like Fox cards they'll do periodically. Like, they did one last fall, which ended up being like the precursor to the Santa Cruz Mares rematch. So basically he said, like, Keith Thurman has indicated, like, he's aiming for a much lower level of competition.
Wow.
He's not talking about, like, anyone in the top five or top 10 at 147. So they're saying likely they'll do, you know, he spoke coyly, but reading between the lines, that seemed to be what he was saying, because he said, you know, I don't know if he's going to be on this network, or I don't know if he's, you know, we've built up a certain standard for our Showtime main events. So I was like, oh, maybe one of those PBC network shows. And he definitely gave the sort of, you know, in the room with him, it felt like he was answering yes to.
They do have another Fox date coming up. So and the plan is that Victor Ortiz and Brandon Rios would be fighting on Fox.
Yeah, I heard about that one. I feel like that would be a little bit too full, but who knows? You know, they could have a night of welterweights. That could be the same card. I think
maybe
there's still
Thurman can fight the winner
the same night. yeah, I mean, we could definitely look. PBC's, we've talked about this before. They've got so many guys at 147. I mean, you could, it would not be outside of the possibility to see him in with Devin Alexander, Andre. Well, kind of friends, you know. Well, Andre Berto is supposed to fight Devin Alexander, but, you know, you could see Keith Thurman with Devin Alexander. Eh, not so great, but it's something.
They should both fight Thurman, because I think that I'd take Thurman against both of them.
Interesting. Yeah, that reminds me, there's a clip of Lomachenko sparring two people at once when he was like 14, which is just absolute madness. So, yeah, it's like, maybe not that crazy, as you say that. So another quick bite from the media event. Surprising amount of talk related to Errol Spence and Mikey Garcia. This has come up in the boxing press. Some people have trickled stuff out about this. And, yeah, very surprised when it came up. Spence was more than happy to talk about it. Like, sometimes with other fighters, they'll just say, you know, that's stupid, that's not going to happen. Yeah, he definitely, I mean, it was interesting. I don't know if the idea, I mean, that's an absolute dream fight for him. I mean, this is something I'll get into in a minute here, but very clear understanding that in order to build Errol Spence to the superstar level, one of the pieces they're going to have to do is to try to build up a Hispanic fan base. Like I said, I'll get to that a little more in a second, but, you know, you have Mikey Garcia there. That would be an absolutely fantastic fight to do in Dallas. Again, you know, in Texas, getting the Hispanic fan base there. You know, he'd obviously have a huge size advantage. So in every way that would benefit him. I mean, if Mikey Garcia, it's like, you know, when you have a fighter daring to be great, the flip side of that is you have another fighter who's cashing an easy paycheck. You know, it was great that, Kell Brook wanted to dare to be great against Triple G, but Triple G was more than happy to cash that check. So, yeah, I mean, I guess Errol Spence was, I don't know if it was just either the understanding that they both stand to gain from just some free publicity if the boxing media wants to talk about it, or really just a recognition that, you know, if Mikey Garcia wants to step in the ring, I'm definitely not going to turn it down. You said you had a note on that. Did you have more thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear, like, and to precursor or to preface this, you know, I'm obviously, like most people, a fan of Mikey Garcia. He's great to watch. Clearly one of the most talented fighters in the sport, but you don't need me to tell you that this is a bad idea. It's an absolutely horrible idea on the part of Mikey Garcia. And I understand the confidence, and I understand that time's running out and that big fight needs to emerge sooner rather than later. But at the same time, I can't help but just say that Mikey Garcia is starting to sound like Amir Khan.
Well, Amir Khan made a lot of money getting knocked out by Canelo, so... You know, that's another thing. Mikey Garcia's talked about it. You know, you said time's ticking. He doesn't want to be around the sport forever. You know, that's a pay-per-view for him, potentially. I could definitely imagine Spence giving him... I mean, that's the flip side. It's like, you know, would Spence give him, like, you know, an 80-20 split, give Garcia all the money just to do the fight? You know, could it be a situation like that? I mean, yeah, I was very surprised. I mean, that's the sort of thing when I was putting my questions together for that event. That's the sort of, I mean, there are always topics you can ask fighters, but it's like, why? You know, it's things they don't want to talk about or you don't think will lead anywhere. Very surprised how much that was discussed. I mean, he really, like, when it came up, he was definitely, like, that was a question he was prepared for and he had answers ready. You have more to say about that, or should I get on to the next bullet here?
No, go on.
Sure. So then the next little quick hit, this is a very quick hit, asking about Mandown Promotions. This had come up, but I hadn't really seen any reporting on it, that his fight against Ocampo, was co-promoted by his new promotion company, Man Down Promotions, and just felt like hadn't, and no one had really asked him about it. And he said, as of right now, is like the way I phrased the question, I think, was, you know, is this mainly just a vehicle to promote you, or are you actually trying to assign fighters? And basically he said he's you know, mainly it's to promote himself. It's a vehicle for himself. But he is expecting to sign a few fighters. He had two guys from his gym were fighting on the card. I don't have their names in front of me right now. I guess that would have been good. But
I think one of them is the guy he sparred with that he posted
Adrian
the picture
Taylor
with.
Is one of them. Yeah, exactly. The guy, the Machamp to his Machop. So yeah, the version of Errol Spence that someone shot with an enlargement ray. Yeah, he's one of the guys. And then there's another guy who, I think Mexican American, from their gym as well. So, yeah, I thought that was interesting. So looks like probably future fights, you can expect to see those guys on the undercard. And again, that's the sort of, I mentioned this before we got on, it's kind of the surreal thing of one of these events. You know, it's like, I asked him that question and then someone else who was in the room, who is a sports reporter for the New York Daily News, wrote an article based on that, you know, based on the answer he gave to my question. And then someone posted that article to Reddit. So, you know, it's just the surreal situation. It's like, you know, I was sitting like 2 feet from, you know, I was sitting like 3 feet from Errol Spence and like sitting right next to this guy. And it's like, I'm having a conversation with Errol Spence. This guy takes his notes, writes in the New York Daily News about it. And then we see it on the sub. It's just like, yeah, anyway, I'm still, it's like so surreal being part of this boxing reporting stuff, you know, still a fanboy at heart. It's so fun to get to do this. One last quick hit from that event. Spence and Steven Espinoza both mentioned this. So this was like a talking point they wanted to get out of the event that I feel like hasn't really been reported on. It was talking about one of the elements of the partnership with the Dallas Cowboys, that the Dallas Cowboys do an extreme amount of outreach for Mexican fans. They've hosted Mexican national soccer team at the stadium. They've over time had numerous former soccer player kickers. So apparently the Dallas Cowboys, like, I had never known this, but that's another big piece that people have talked about, this pairing between Spence and the Dallas Cowboys being a great pairing, because, you know, Dallas Cowboys, big organization in Dallas. Spence can fight at AT&T Stadium going forward, but very helpful for both parties, both as far as like the Dallas Cowboys organization wanting to do boxing, because they are very actively engaged trying to build up Hispanic fans and Mexican fans in general, you know, Mexican fans and Hispanic fans in general. And boxing is a great road to do that. I mean, if you wondered why they've really tried to get, you know, Canelo there, had a huge fight with Canelo there, tried to get Pacquiao there, had pretty big fights with Pacquiao there. So, you know, it's this mutually beneficial situation. They want to have boxing to help build up that side of the fan base. And then it's also helpful for Spence building his brand and, you know, to some extent promoting these fights in Texas, but also help, you know, Triple G had that very, very deliberate outreach to Mexican fans going for this Mexican style brand.
I mean, I've said this many, 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 many times in the past, but the Hispanic fan base is what drives this sport. And it's probably pretty unique in that boxing, well, I can't say that it's unique because it's not like boxing ratings are killing any other sports, but there's a large subset of boxing popularity that is driven by the Mexican fan base, which, or Hispanic fan base, which may not be there for other sports. And while it's probably not, you know, a huge difference, but I'm sure when you're Jerry Jones, if you can get a million extra viewers, you're doing it. Because that's a million extra people buying tickets. That's a million extra people buying jerseys and license plates or whatever you buy for your Dallas Cowboys merch. But obviously, they're looking at how to keep increasing, how to keep pushing the numbers. And I'm sure that this is one very a unique way, at least. I don't know that this has the biggest return. I mean, obviously they've thought it out, and they think this is the biggest, or this is one of the bigger things that they can do to grow the Dallas Cowboys. But you know, maybe this is why the Cowboys are America's team, why they're one of the most popular franchises in all of sports around the world.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I wouldn't say it's just a single thing. I mean, I think, you know, if you're a smart business person, you look for growth in every area that you can. But it was just interesting to find this, that, like, I hadn't known this, but just, yeah, like, countrywide, like, you know, the Cowboys are considered like by far the most popular team among like Hispanic fans. You know, it's always so weird to say this, like I'm sure for people who don't follow boxing, like it'd be weird to keep talking about Hispanics. But as you said, it's like the Mexican fans drive the industry. So, yeah, I thought that was an interesting note. Like Steven Espinosa also said he spent some time while he was growing up in Dallas. And that he, you know, obviously Hispanic himself, had been a big fan of the Dallas Cowboys. And a big part of that at that time was that they had a Mexican kicker who he noted, I guess he wanted to cover his base. I guess that guy ended up being a pedophile. So he was like, I don't want to put my my name on this guy too much. But as a kid, I was a fan of him because he was.
Steven Espinosa's fan of, well, I'm not even going to go there. I thought of doing it, but
nothing more to say about that. Anyway, I just thought that was an interesting note. There's like, so again, it's like there's always more going on behind the scenes. There's more thinking behind these moves than we're really aware of. So both on the part of the Dallas Cowboys and on the part of Spence's team.
I mean, I thought about all of them, but I'm not sharing them.
Well, okay. Anyway, that's it for the media event. It was, again, it was just like, it was really cool to get to go to that. And I think those were all the quick hits I had out of that.
Okay, well, Oscar Valdez is saying he wants to fight Leo Santa Cruz or some other way around it. It's very obvious that those two guys wouldn't fight each other. I mean, the options that they both have, well, at least Santa Cruz has on his side of the pond, don't make this a fight that is going to happen anytime soon. Now, in my opinion, it's a fight that would be great. You have two Mexican fighters who can draw a little bit, at least Valdez can draw a little bit in LA. Obviously Santa Cruz a big draw here. You do this fight here in LA, you have two great styles, two guys that aren't going to knock each other out. I mean, you have a war on your hands if you match these guys up together. So I think you save this one. You hope that they could basically stay where they're at for a couple years. Because I get the sense that this is a fight that if you put these two dudes in the ring together, they're going to get hurt. Or at least their careers are getting shortened. They're just way too aggressive. Santa Cruz would really have to box. And I think he very well could box Valdez if he wants to get out without taking much damage. But Valdez is a dude that sells out. I mean, what did you want to go over with this fight?
I mean, I agree. That would be an absolutely amazing fight if it happened. I wouldn't have a hard time picking Santa Cruz, I think, style-wise. I think a little bit left to prove coming back from a broken jaw in his last fight. I think Valdez is looking very vulnerable right now. So I don't expect a tough opponent for him in his next fight. Yeah, really the reason why I put this down, I just think it's interesting, like, if you look back, like, having followed the sport for a while, Top Rank, more than any other promoter, as much as what they say, really ends up always ending up with in-house fights. You know, they'll talk big, they'll call their people out, then it's an in-house opponent. And I think something that's interesting, like, lots of times they won't even call people out unless they have a reason to. Like, if you go back a few years, like Keith Thurman and Sean Porter trying to get, you know, Timothy Bradley in the ring, trying to get Manny Pacquiao, some of the guys on the Top Rank side. If you look at from the time Floyd Mayweather basically wound down his career, there was this brief period of time where really, like, the names were on the Top Rank side. I think that kind of went away when Manny Pacquiao lost to Jeff Horn with Finality, Bradley, you're retired, and now you have, you know, really a handful of guys on the PBC side who are, like, arguably as big of draws as Terrence Crawford, who's really their only name there. Anyway, the point being, you have this strange power dynamic where, like, it's hard to imagine that they want to be calling guys out on the other side of the street, but they don't really have a choice. I mean, there really aren't viable options for Oscar Valdez, and as you said, fight's unlikely to happen. So if he's calling out Leo Santa Cruz, he really doesn't really stand to lose anything, because it's not like, one, the fight's probably not going to happen, you know, so he gets to look like the big guy who's calling him out. And, you know, if it could happen, that would probably be good for him because he has no options. So I just thought it was interesting. It's just an interesting sort of data point about, you know, where we stand in the game today to see, you know, who's calling out who and why. And to segue into the, I don't know if you have more to say about that, but this related point, Bob Arum calling out Amir Khan for Terrence Crawford again. Interesting to see, like, related to Errol Spence with Terrence Crawford, Bob Arum said, well, you know, that fight will happen when I can get 500,000 buys on pay-per-view. Certainly doesn't have a problem you know, calling out Amir Khan, the most most likely fighter in the sport to produce a knockout every time out. Fortunately for him, he's on the receiving side of that. So
Bob Arum's like 90 years old. He said Amir Khan, but he probably meant someone else. He probably meant Keith Thurman or something.
I don't know. I think he meant Amir Khan. I mean, if you look at that group of people, who does he want to fight?
You can't possibly put Amir Khan's name in the same sentence as Terrence Crawford. Like, that's just not safe.
Terrence Crawford is going to fight Jose Benavidez in his next fight, almost certainly. I think that's what everyone's saying. Is that much of a worse fight than Amir Khan? I mean, is that much better of a fight than Amir Khan?
No, it's not, because Amir Khan, his chin is not questionable, to quote Errol Spence. We know he got no chin.
Yeah, right. The questions have been answered.
And you're going to put him in there with Terrence Crawford. I mean, at least Jose Benavidez is young. He's still got a career. You know, Amir Khan's trying to wind his down and ride off into the sunset. And the last thing he wants is to get just demoralized by Terrence Crawford. I mean,
That's why I put it on the show notes, though. Isn't it weird that Arum called him out of all people? I mean, I guess you're just chalking it up to senility, but isn't that weird?
No, I think it's clearly a move that you put. Right now, some of the most vocal fan bases are the UK ones. Well, you get the UK people talking about Terrence Crawford. That's all you're doing. This is a dog whistle.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And Arum knows how to work this thing. You know, the reason why he always calls out PBC guys is he knows that nobody's going to come to their rescue. He knows that Al Heyman's not going to come out and say, yeah, let's make this fight. He's going to leave it up to the fighters, and the fighters probably don't even care sometimes, or they'll say something. But, I mean, it's the exact same thing we saw with, I mean, just go back to the Manny Pacquiao negotiations with Adrian Broner and Danny Garcia, which never actually happened, and then you get tossed out a Jesse Vargas, and it's like, look, Bob Arum's done this over and over and over and over again. He's very good at what he does. Just the way Eddie Hearn's great at pushing a narrative, so is Bob Arum. And Bob Arum does it a different way. He does it, I mean, I like Arum's way more, because at the end of the day, he uses other fighters. He uses their names to get his fighters in the news and then fight someone else. It's a great idea. Like, I can't fault Arum for that whatsoever. So that's what I think it is. If you're bringing him up, you know, Amir Khan built most of his legacy and his popularity on talking about Floyd Mayweather. Over and over again, this dude's like 7-0. He's like, I want to fight Floyd Mayweather. And it's like, dude, you just got knocked out of lightweight. Settle down. Floyd Mayweather's fighting at 147. This isn't happening. But he kept doing it. And soon enough, he was fighting on pay-per-view. And he's a big draw in the sport. I think that's mostly what's happening here. I mean, I could be wrong. Arum could be serious. But if he is, he should be imprisoned. We could talk about the fights this week. This is a kind of a quiet week. I'm kind of disappointed.
Yeah, it's gearing up to be a slow month. Yeah, there's really not a lot on the calendar.
Well, that's the last. June has Mikey Garcia fighting, so like that's a great month if you ask me.
Well, yeah, right at the end. But yeah, it's like I'm just saying from now until it's like we've got multiple weeks coming up, not a lot of fights or not a lot of significant fights. But yeah, we should still preview the action. We got multiple cards this week.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, no, I'm you're not looking forward to the Jaime Munguia Liam Smith fight?
You know what, I actually am. I'm sort of curious to see how real Munguia is. So yeah, I actually
hope he's real. I really, really hope he's real. And I just want to say, in 3 weeks, Regis Prograis fights, which he's gonna fight a no-hoper.
Yeah, no-hoper, and yeah,
Teofimo Lopez fights on the undercard, who I think is the number one prospect in boxing right now.
Really? I am so not sold on him.
Well, I guess you're really sold on Josh Taylor then. 29-year-old prospect. Good for you. Is that who you were going to say? Please tell me you're not going to say Josh Taylor.
As far as my favorite prospect?
Yeah, at least humor me and say Josh Kelly.
No, I mean, I'm really not even going to give you an answer on that. I just, like, Teofimo Lopez is another guy, in my opinion, like, really faced over match competition.
Dude, that's what prospects do!
Yeah, but again, it's like, when there's, okay, look, there's, levels to this still. If you're looking at a fighter with 19 losses, you know, that's not the same thing as fighting a fighter who's like, you know, 20-2 and has gone the distance with like another prospect who, and he like that, you know, gave that guy a rough fight. Like there are multiple levels of this. I'll just say again, similar to Virgil Ortiz, Teofimo Lopez has not been in it with anyone where I feel like I can extrapolate out from that to see how he would do on the world level. I'm just really not sold on it. Also, his father has replaced Angel Garcia as the most obnoxious father in the sport. So, partly just annoyed by the whole shtick on his side.
He's
succeeding at moving the dial, but I don't know. I don't know how much credit I'm supposed to give him for that. Anyway, I just wanted to add Charles Conwell is also fighting on that card, who's another prospect that I like, on the Rita's Pergay card.
Wasn't that impressive in the Olympics, but obviously amateurs, some guys just aren't cut out to be great amateurs, but they get in the pros and they can sure work. But that's prospect talk that if you want to hear more prospect talk.
Yeah, we talk quickly about the fights this week.
Get on the Patreon or something. We'll talk about that there. So Gilberto Ramirez will fight Romer Angulo, which that should tell you enough. Like, just who is Romer Angulo? Nobody you've ever heard of. Some guy who's probably the toughest guy in his country that has a total of 45 people fighting in that division. So basically like a UFC division champion. So Gilberto Ramirez is coming back and I don't know why Top Rank, like I've tried to make excuses for them because obviously I like Ramirez. But I don't know why, like, do they not think he's good? Are they just seeing how far they can push this and say, hey, just throw him out there with another guy he's going to beat? If they keep watching it, then just, you know, we'll go with it. I can't remember. He's not coming off of injury, is he?
I have a very specific answer to this, which I think is just they want him to be getting knockouts on TV. And we've seen that even with extremely limited opposition, he has still not been able to produce knockouts. So I think they're trying to keep it at a level where he can build up a few knockouts, because he had built up the reputation for a while that he was not knocking out guys he should knock out. I'll just say separately also, I mean, it's a point of frustration, like Top Rank, I mean, his last opponent was much, much worse than this even. I mean, Habib Ahmed, he was something like 95th in BoxRec or something like that. You know, just crazy, just so far below. Yeah, it's like after the loss now he's ranked 124 on BoxRec. Yeah, again, as I'm saying, BoxRec ranking is not perfect, but it's a rough indicator. I mean, Top Rank's justification at that time was, you know, oh, well, you know, the top guys are tied up in the World Boxing Super Series, so this is like,
which
you know,
you chose
find
not to
else.
Join.
Well, yeah, chose not to join, but it's also like, okay, so the top, like, you know, like five of the guys in the top 10 are tied up, something like that, however you want to rate the World Boxing Super Series roster. Okay, but that doesn't mean you need to fight number 90, right? Like, fight like number 11 in the division. Fight like number 8 in the division. You know, it's like they're going so far below in their level of competition. And again, we get here Romer Angulo, who's 34 and doesn't have a single significant win on his resume. I mean, to say it again, I already said it multiple times, I just see this as they want to build up a few more. They don't really have any significant fights for him. Also, just, you know, again, why is this fight happening? Based on this new Top Rank deal with the ESPN Plus app, I mean, this one is on mainline ESPN. But, I don't know if you're being sarcastic, but yeah, $5 a month. I'm really been won over by it, actually. You know, they're just the sheer volume of fights they're putting on. But anyway, that's
League of Legends tournaments you're watching, huh?
Well, the 30 for 30s are good. Dan Rachel's got his show.
You can't possibly be watching that.
No, I have not watched it yet. I'm sort of wanting to watch it, but yeah, I just haven't gotten around to it. But anyway, yeah, simple point I was trying to make is that they have a lot of dates they have to fill. So that you know, puts it more towards trying to get guys who are some baseline level of marketability and then just do a bunch of dates with them. You know, in my opinion, Ramirez barely passes that threshold, but they're still doing that. I mean, it's a tough proposition. I mean, you know, again, like you have Oscar Valdez getting beaten up so badly in his last fight. He won, but Do you want to have a fight like that where your guy's out for, you know, 6 months and then you have to rehab him? Or do you want to fight like Romer Angulo, where Gilberto Ramirez is going to have a super easy night, hopefully get a knockout, and then can, you know, they can look to get him back on TV again in 3 months?
Neither's obviously a very good choice. I would take option C and try to bring over some British fighters and beat up on those guys. Get those guys talking about you. Because I mean, ultimately, I think Ramirez will be a dud for Top Rank. He's not going to draw the way they think he's going to draw or they want him to draw. And there are other guys at 168 emerging that are basically going to pass him up. You know, I just think that at some point in time, it looked like this was going to be, like, he was going to be the guy to take over this era of boxing. And as he started to make his ascent,
I never thought that.
Well, as a draw, as a name.
Sure. Okay.
Not like as the best guy.
So marketable. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically as like the figurehead of the division. You know, there are guys that are figureheads of their general weight area that they may not be the number one guy. Canelo's that guy. He's not number one at middleweight. That's Golovkin. But he's the name carrying the banner. And Benavidez emerged. And if Benavidez beats Durrell, what are they going to do? I mean, think about it this way. If Top Rank tried to sign Benavidez, they're trying to work out something with Jose Uzcategui. Like, why did they sign them? Or what's the interest in them?
Right. Yeah, you stole my point. Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to sort of close on about this. It's not for no reason that they were trying to get to David Benavidez over. That wasn't as an opponent, you know.
It's either a cash out or they think that they want to test him and say, like, hey, look, sink or swim. And if he beats those guys, obviously he's pretty good. Obviously, you know, I think we both realize he's not going to beat them.
Yeah, Ramirez is not terrible. He's certainly not going to be in tough this weekend. It's, you know, it's hard to see what the long-term plan is for him at this point, though.
Yeah, so we can move on. We have a couple of prospects fighting. Alex Saucedo, who's on the rise and will be headlining a card very soon, or at least you'll see in a headlining position. This is a guy that I've, like, kind of watched since he maybe was, like, 3-0. And I mean, I'm still not sure what to think of him. Like, he's obviously a talented fighter, but I don't know that he translates at the world level. We have Rashidi Ellis fighting, who I'm fairly confident that I don't think he kind of I think maybe him and
Sosedo
are
the
same
card.
Yeah, so these are all ESPN cards, ESPN Plus, ESPN 2, ESPN regular. Rashidi Ellis and Sosedo, I'd say, are in the same category of, like, these guys can probably challenge for a world title someday, but I'm not going to sit here and tell you they're going to win a title and make some defenses. I don't see that in either of these guys' futures. I could be wrong, you know, totally. I wouldn't be shocked if I was wrong. But from what I've seen so far, they haven't really just done much to prove that they're ready for that. And then Joe Smith Jr. fights this week, which you're going to go to that fight. Where is the fight at?
It's at the Mohegan Sun.
Is that in New York?
It's in Connecticut. It's an Indian casino in the middle of Connecticut.
Oh, yeah.
So,
is it near Westchester?
Again, not really. I mean, yeah, Connecticut borders New York. So it's, not super close. But, just a few comments on some of these things. I mean, looking forward to the Joe Smith fight. We've got some friends in Boston, so we're going to meet in the middle in Connecticut. Should be fun. Ticket sales have done quite well, actually. I've got a few gifts planned for this week on the sub to hype up, get some Joe Smith hype going. just regarding some names you mentioned already, I'd put Alex Saucedo on here. I'm sort of curious what your thoughts are on him. You know, he's at Top Rank. He's at 140. Seems to me like a no-brainer that they're building up a collision between him and Jose Ramirez. Any thoughts on that premise?
There's overlap between the two of those guys. I think they do a lot of the same things. From memory and also from just looking at fights against opponents that clearly won't be as good as Jose Ramirez, Saucedo can probably box a little bit more.
than at least he's more disciplined, I think, at boxing. Ramirez is kind of like a pedal to the metal kind of guy. So there's always been something about, so like there was a slew of top ranked prospects that came out at the same time. Eric De Leon, Alex Salcedo, Ivan Nahera. Who else did we have? There's Jose Ramirez, Felix Verdejo. There's some of these guys were signed out
of
the...
So sort of like the 2012 class.
Yeah, out of the 2012 Olympics, as well as just guys that they had. Obviously, some fell by the wayside, some I didn't even mention. And then you have these guys who are still left standing or still in the prospect phase, which is where Salcedo is right now. And Salcedo never stuck out as one of the top guys. He only stuck out as maybe one of the guys that could possibly turn out. You know, the guys who had immediate star power, or at least where you could project them at the top, was a Jose Ramirez, was Verdejo, who's since flamed out and has looked completely awful. He's been stopped. Eric De Leon, I think, is the one that, in my eyes at least, Eric De Leon looked like the one with a real bright future that would be slept on because, for whatever reason, I think around that time there was Christopher Diaz too, and Saul Rodriguez, who ended up going with Mayweather Promotions, and I don't know what he's done. I mean, you might remember Eric De Leon fought on the what card was it? The Oscar Valdez Scott Quigg card, actually. He fought on the undercard and had that draw with Andy Vences. And Vences is the guy who was on no one's radar and is starting to look like, wow, he might be the best because that was a draw, but we all know Vences won the fight. I mean, De Leon came on late, but Vences won that fight, no doubt about it. So, but obviously this is about Alex Salcedo. He's done well, but he's still in that phase where we're not quite sure what he's going to do. He's only 24, so he's got time. I'm just not putting my reputation on the line right here and backing him.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that was the thing that stood out to me, that he's at 140 and they need opponents for, you know,
but you're right about the trajectory of his career. Yeah. It's clearly to feed him or feed Ramirez to him. Either way, I think Top Rank will be happy if they just have a great fight and whoever wins, wins, and they can do a rematch, or they both get launched off into semi-boxing stardom, if not full-on boxing stardom.
Yeah, and one last thing about that, very last thing. He's fighting Lenny Z, Leonardo Sapovina, who put on a very, very fun action fight against Sergey Lipinets in 2016. So should be fun as long as it lasts. I mean, definitely have to favor Salcedo in that fight, but you know, Lenny Z is a good dance partner.
Yeah, so depending on where he's at as far as like what he's got left in the tank, like if Salcedo's a little too crude, Lenny Z could beat him. Like, Lenny Z is the kind of guy who, when he's going to go in there, he's going to throw with you. And if you're not tight, you're going to get yourself stopped. Look at what he did to Ik Yang. Ik Yang was a Chinese prospect or something Chinese. I think it was from China. Let me just double check this. Yeah, from China. And Ik Yang had been beaten by Cesar Rene Cuenca, but everyone kind of felt like that was a fluke. And obviously, Cuenca was a bad matchup for Yang because Yang was literally like thawed out from ice, you know? And Cuenca, the pure boxer, Yang ended up losing the fight, but whatever. Lenny Z was the guy that you would put in Yang in because Yang was like just so charismatic. Like, Yang is the kind of guy that you wish turned out because boxing would be better with Ik Yang. I mean, Ik Yang's the kind of guy that is pointing at his opponent on the floor while they're getting up from a knockdown and just doing the throat-slitting motion to them. Like, that's Ik Yang. the guy that thinks this is wrestling, okay? And Lenny Z was supposed to be a guy that Ik Yang gets in there and beats, and, you know, he's back. Ik Yang ends up getting stopped by Lenny Z because Ik Yang, like I said, thawed from ice and just did not have the fundamental skill to be successful in boxing. So that's why I think this is going to be a real nice challenge for Salcedo. You know, obviously with Lenny Z's three losses, you can look at this and say, oh, it's not that great of an opponent. No, this is a really nice is a nice opponent for Saucedo to measure where he's at. I guess the word I'm looking for is benchmark. And then I want to say something about Joe Smith Jr. And I want to—I don't know if you've heard this, but I've heard that Joe Smith Jr. just bet against him because he had some problems with his broken jaw, and he's not been fully committed to boxing because he's actually got—he's become a very successful businessman in the wake of his loss to Sullivan Barrera, which is great for him. But he's back boxing, and that if that jaw injury isn't fully healed, then this is going to be a very bad night for Joe Smith Jr. Have you heard that? What do you know about that?
I think I probably heard the same thing you did. I don't remember who it was, but someone in the chat or one of the chats dropped that little bit of knowledge.
He's in with him because he's he probably shouldn't have told me. I'm not exposing him right here though.
I won't say who it was
or at least but
I mean he's in with a 39-year-old 11-4 opponent, so you know, I think Joe Smith Jr. can get the job done. That's partly, I was mentioning before, I made some highlight clips of Joe Smith. I'm looking forward to putting on the sub this week. So if you watch his knockout of Andrew Fonfara, you know, it's like such a crazy knockout. And if you watch the clip of him knocking Bernard Hopkins out of the ring, you know, it's like Joe Smith. Well, that's actually the way that I'm going to present it. I'm going to lay the audio of Bernard Hopkins saying, you know, he pushed me out of the ring over the highlight that shows there's like every single like bit of contact was like a clean punch. It's just like, oh my God, Hopkins was such a sore loser about that. But yeah, anyway, it's
I was
like,
there. I didn't see a punch land. I saw a push.
Joe Smith is limited, but you know, he's a fun little, the whole, you know, the common
little?
Man. Smith Jr. No, I just mean, well, little in terms of depth, in terms of what he
depth?
Has to offer the sport. But yeah, he's a power puncher. I think he'll go and get the job done against Melvin Russell. I think he has enough depth to get that done. I think that was, oh God, this is, if we can go back a second about that Top Rank ESPN card. Also features the return of Mike Alvarado, which really more the question is, you know, one, it's amazing he's still fighting, but also, what does Top Rank have planned with him? Where is the cash out going to be on Mike Alvarado? That's the question I pose to you.
In the streets.
Okay. I meant more like, are they going to try to credibly present a Terrence Crawford versus Mike Alvarado fight at some point? Are they going to put Alvarado against Manny Pacquiao and the Lucas Matisse fight falls through?
Look, I've been waiting for that fight since 2015.
Yeah, well, I
or
mean,
is
again,
it 20...
it's just...
13.
Top Rank is trying to
he could fight the winner of Rios and Victor Ortiz.
Yeah, well, I guess he could. I mean, they're on the other side of the street. But
can we bring Jesus Soto Carras back?
Yeah, I mean, but that's the point though. It's like we're joking about it, but this is happening. Like he's fighting this weekend. It's
you
crazy.
Think I'm joking? I'm not. Like, why not? They were already making these fights, so just make this one too.
Your dream of the washed welterweight tournament that you've talked about for years.
I got a bracket going right now. Miguel's advanced into the second round.
Oh God!
Only because Miguel Cotto retired. I can't wait for Alexander and Umberto.
I am interested to see how that fight goes, but yeah, I mean, it's funny. Just touch on that very quickly. I know we're all over the place and going super long, but so funny to me. They're like trying to make this thing happen on the PBC side where they have all these like, you know, guys like a level below, like, and they're trying to get them to the level where they'll be like credible opponents for the like guys who are, you know, tier up like Keith Thurman, Danny Garcia, Sean Porter, Errol Spence. But like, you know, it's like Devin Alexander, they put him in with Victor Ortiz. All he has to do is beat Victor Ortiz, which you'd think would not be that tough of a proposition. Like Victor Ortiz is practically ready to just like fall on the canvas with a broken jaw. Could not get the job done, walked away with a draw. So now they have to put him in with Berto to try to see, okay, well, he was not able to emerge into a viable contender status with Victor Ortiz. Okay, well, put him in Berto. We'll see what happens. And
well,
I feel
everyone
like
knows
fight...
he's not good. That's the problem.
Like, well, but yeah.
You will not convince anybody, especially at this point in 2018, you cannot beat Victor Ortiz and expect that people are going to think you're good. It's not happening. I don't care who you are.
This is the point I was trying to make, though. Like, why is Mike Alvarado, why is Top Rank still putting him on the card? What is the eventual cash out move? Do you think they're not going to try to put him in with Manny Pacquiao or Terrence Crawford? I mean, I think that's very likely. I'm just sort of trying to call it out now, because it's like, when that happens, you're going to have fanboys going like, yo, man, like, he's got a chance against Crawford. Like, you know, I wouldn't, you know, it's like,
literally,
if this happens,
nobody
this
will
happens,
say that. Nobody, not even Alvarado's people are going to say that. They're going to be like, hey, bro, they're paying you a lot of money. You got to take this fight. That's what they're going to say. Like, nobody's delusional.
Again, we joke, but it's like, is it really that far off to imagine that match will be made?
I think there are, you know, you can do the all street matchup of Mike Alvarado versus Jose Benavides.
Do Chicago street fight style, like they come into the ring wearing their street clothes like they would in the WWF. Yeah,
it's E-Brother, get the F out.
Anyway, I think that's as much as I have to say about any of those fights. Do you have any other topics?
No, I mean, when you bring up Mike Alvarado, I know it's time to sign off.
Yeah, that's the go-home topic. Yeah, I'm good.
All right, well, it's not a phone call, Tom, so you can't exactly just say, I'm good. That's not how this works.
Yeah, but we talk it out. Yeah, sign up for the social media feed, sign up for Patreon.
Yep. And I mentioned this at the beginning of the podcast, sign up for Patreon, sign up for, well, not sign up, but go rate their podcast, please. Leave a great rating, leave a review. Don't leave 1 star, leave 5 stars. And if you got any questions, concerns, feedback, anything like that, hit us up. You can get on our Discord, you can go talk with any one of us, just add us, or just say, I'm here for this guy, and someone will point you in the right direction. And I don't know about you, but I, you know, when people PM me, I like getting into these PM discussions about boxing. You know, sometimes the general chat's a little hard to have a conversation in, because you got everybody just throwing in their 2 cents, but it's a lot of fun having private conversations about, you know, some of these things that we talk about on the podcast, or, you know, because there's obviously things that, you know, the podcast is a certain limit, so I can't go into every single detail about these subjects. But if that's your thing,
sometimes
go for it, man.
It seems like it.
No, I mean, I could go on forever. You know, I can go on forever about some of these topics.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so, I'll just do a quick shout out here. If you guys are in Connecticut, come check out the Joe Smith fight. Come say hi to me. We'll get a drink. Otherwise,
are you going to buy him a drink?
You don't matter. No, I'm definitely not going to make that offer. Because who knows how many. how many townies from central Connecticut are going to come out looking for free drinks? I don't think my wall can keep up with that.
All right, man. You know what? I don't know if that's true, but we'll sign off here. Thanks for coming on, and we'll be back next week.
Sure. Talk to you later. My loved. So hard to choose.